are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, January 7th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the editor of Current Affairs Magazine, author of Why You Should Be a Socialist, Nathan J. Robinson, will join us. Also on the program today, the U.S. military sends a letter declaring we are pulling out of Iraq and says that was a mistake. Sorry.
Psych.
Pentagon rejects Donald Trump's threat to target Iranian cultural sites, so we've got that going for us. United States bars the Iranian foreign minister from entering this country to speak with the UN. And John Bolton now claims he'll answer a Senate subpoena to testify as Murkowski and Collins fold to Mitch McConnell on witnesses. Meanwhile, the 2020 race, Sanders and Warren set to unleash on Biden. And U.S. to start collecting DNA at the border. Back to that Democratic debate. It looks now to be five people. Klobuchar, Buttigieg, Biden, Sanders, and Warren.
I love the Klobuchar dead-enders so much.
There you go. Well, who knows? Who knows? She's still in it. And lastly, up to a billion animals have died in the Australian wildfires as they continue to rage. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, the stuff that's happening in Australia is just... It's a nightmare. We got a call the other day from someone in Melbourne who told us that they have ash in Melbourne, which is, I think, hundreds of miles away from the nearest fires. I've been following various threads on Twitter, reading about just what a hellscape it is. It's a real... it's a horror. And I mean, not to mention the temperatures are just incredibly and seemingly unbearably high across the country. So this is, the thing that's very, I think, hard to really digest is that it doesn't get better from here. This is not... There may be a respite from this in Australia, in the specific places, right? There may be some downtime from raging fires in California, let's say. But it doesn't get better in an extended and ongoing basis anywhere. It's only going to get worse. And so...
We do have the technology to make sure that it doesn't get too much worse, but the primary obstacles are political.
Yeah, of course.
So get to work, everyone.
Political, yeah, of course. I mean, it is so much of it is about sort of will and competitions of will. I don't know. There's I did also get an email. And it's a bit long to discuss, but of course, sort of the brunt of this, as in as it will be, at least, you know, in any situation, particularly with any type of natural disaster, but also I think probably man-made, that indigenous people and people without wealth are the ones who are going to pay the biggest price, at least initially.
And geographically distributed. I mean, you know, it's the Amazon is literally genocidal towards indigenous people, but just even... I was watching an interview with the Prime Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis, and he's just like, yeah, like we have to develop these climate strategies for our island with pretty limited resources and net emissions of basically nothing.
Right. I mean, and, you know, this is it's always the canary in the coal mine is basically that explains just about every dynamic and every danger that that we have. And the canary in this instance is just those people who are most vulnerable because they either lack resources specifically or they lack sort of financial resources or material resources or political resources. I mean, that's basically the way that almost every dynamic can be explained. I mean, even the story of the U.S. to start collecting DNA at the border. It's a pilot program, folks. It's a pilot program. And it's a pilot program. It sounds so much more fun when it's a pilot program, doesn't it? We're trying out some new stuff. See if it's going to work.
But
U.S. government.
That's a zany character.
Exactly.
White guy.
Well, it's not quite that type of pilot. But the U.S. government on Monday has launched a pilot program to collect DNA from people in immigration custody and submit it to the FBI. It's plans to expand it nationwide. People as young as 14 will be subject to DNA collection. And the information will go into a massive criminal database run by the FBI where it would be held indefinitely. In other words, forever. A memo outlining the program published Monday in the Department of Homeland Security said U.S. citizens and permanent residents holding a green card who are detained could be subject to DNA testing, as well as asylum seekers and people entering the country without authorization. And now I've got news for you, folks. Like every other national security, like every other policing, it starts with the most vulnerable, those people who have the least political power or material power, sometimes both, one or the other. And it's a pilot. They're testing it out. They're getting the bugs out of it. And then it'll just come to all of us. First, it'll be just American citizens who enter into the criminal justice system. And then it'll be people who just get pulled over for traffic violations. And then it's like, if you want to take a flight, got to give us some of your DNA. That way we can get you through quicker. And then it's just it'll replace easy passes. And so if you want to pay for tolls, you're coming across the bridge and then boom, boom, boom. And then we all have, I can't tell you what's going to be wrong or problematic with this massive database of DNA. I don't know that the government, frankly, has the resources to make it as problematic as, say, like when people break into it will, or when at one point somebody says, we've got all this DNA, we should sell it to pharmaceutical companies via some type of NIH grant or something. I mean, that's ultimately that'll be what the problem is. But this is the way, you know, this is the way we roll in this country. Let's get back to the matter at hand, which is the Trump administration's seemingly desire either to get into a war with Iran or make it feel like we're going to get into a war with Iran or just shake stuff up. You know, one of the things that I don't know if there is a Republican foreign policy establishment anymore, frankly, that is not consistent with a neocon one. The Republican foreign policy, I guess, the Republican foreign policy, doctrinally speaking, seems to me to have been the Obama administration, with perhaps a slight derivation here or there. You know, sort of like a realism, but still fairly militaristic. And we're just going to focus more on special ops and keep those low level, realpolitik. Everything else more or less the same. The Republican foreign policy primary doctrine seems to be neoconservatism. And because even Donald Trump, who was supposedly breaking that mold, right, cannot staff anybody but these neoconservatives in his administration. There just doesn't seem to be any other Republican foreign policy apparatus. And so what we're seeing now could be basically, I think, a twofer. I think Donald Trump, you know, this is Paul Wolfowitz sitting down and saying this is the one thing that we could agree upon was weapons of mass destruction, even though there wasn't any. We just we all needed something that we could sign on to that wouldn't interfere with our particular agendas. And I think that's what we're probably witnessing now, which is Donald Trump is like, so this will help me with my campaign, A, B. And so I will get that hotel in Riyadh or in.
He said that if I kill him, they will get Ivanka a duty-free shop at the Kuala Lumpur airport. I think the answer speaks for itself.
I mean, that's not even funny. I don't know what the specific get was, but the idea that there wasn't one of those gets would be.
There's never been a branded partnership with Ralph Lauren perfumes before.
Exactly. I mean, there's something. And then the other element of it is that clearly guys like Pompeo and Milley and Pence and whatever other names, you know, Secretary Raytheon, and what other names that we don't know who make up the sort of like, the lieutenant level foreign policy advisors to those, you know, the undersecretaries, basically, of those people. They all probably subscribe to this idea that anything we can do to destabilize that region, even if it's unpredictable, is good. Like, Dick Cheney, I don't think has had a single day in his life since shock and awe where he thought Iraq didn't work out well. I don't think he's had a single day where he didn't think, mission accomplished.
It did.
Exactly.
There was contracts awarded. The regimes were destabilized. They don't care about the proliferation.
They don't care about anything else. And I think like the destabilization, it goes like this, folks. Like if you perceive yourself as, in terms of the United States, to be a hundred story tower in a city of other buildings, none of which get past 60 stories, or maybe there's one or two other buildings that are 100-story towers. If there's some type of event that knocks out 50 stories from everybody, guess what? There's only you and one or two others standing. Everybody else gets in rubble. And If you're in the penthouse, you're still in the penthouse of that 50-story building. Well, it's 100, now it's 50. But guess what? There's really nothing else. Everything else is still 50 stories behind you, below you at least. And so I think that's the theory. That's the only way to make any type of rational sense of this. That it's not that they don't have a strategy. It's that their strategy, their goals are just escaping most rational people.
Yeah, it's good for business. We got those. Our arms stocks are soaring right now.
It's good for business. It's good for domination. It doesn't matter if it costs us X, Y, or Z because it's costing them more. And that's the theory.
And it distracts the working class of both countries from protesting for their rights and divides people against one another.
It's possible. I think that happens. But I don't know if that's necessarily like...
It's not conscious always, but it does function that way.
Yes, I have no doubt. I mean, certainly it's undercut the reformers in Iran of all
I don't.
Of
I just want to say, I mean, it's under... I think here there's actually less juice for it. I think the public is relatively war-wary in the United States, according to polls. But in Iran, like, I mean, look, I mean, how we responded to September 11th is obscene and has wrecked the world. But the, you know, I don't reject all of the basic impulse of people being angry about that event. There's total validity in that. And so I don't even know. I mean, if you talk to people who are quote unquote reformers in Iran, I don't know. I mean, they would actually say, no, we're not undermined. We're unified. Like, This is totally unacceptable.
Well,
and we're synchronized in our foreign policy view right now. I mean, that's the total message. And, you know, the broader them being – they've been undermined since the day Trump got in office and started killing the Iran deal. I mean, That was what totally
– right.
Because the supreme leader said – he specifically said under Obama, he said, I endorse these negotiations, but I will never trust the United States. So you have my permission to pursue it, but it's not going to end well.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
Well, they're probably feeling a lot of the same feelings that Americans felt on September 11th, and you know how much that changed our culture here. So I don't know why it would be any different over there.
Yeah.
Right.
Here is Kellyanne Conway being asked a question. In fact, a series of questions. Now, these are dogged questions about Donald Trump's tweet. Let's put the tweet up first. The tweet was Donald Trump in the wake of the assassination of Soleimani. And he's saying, Iran is talking very boldly about targeting certain U.S. assets as a revenge for our ridding the world of their terrorist leader who had just killed an American and badly wounded many others, not to mention all the people he killed over his lifetime, including recently hundreds of Iranian protesters. He was already attacking our embassy and preparing for additional hits in other locations. I mean, it's been quite clear that that was not the case. Iran has been nothing but problems for many years. Let this serve as a warning. If Iran strikes any Americans or American assets. Now, this was, of course, in response to both the Hezbollah leader and the Iranian supreme leader saying, hey, reminder, we're not attacking American citizens. No way. No one should do that. When we chant death to America, we're talking about Trump, Bolton and Pompeo. And so Trump is a little bit nervous about his own stuff here. So he goes on to say, let this serve as a warning that if Iran strikes any Americans or American assets, we have targeted 52 Iranian sites and parens representing the 52 American hostages taken by Iran many years ago, which is insane. Some at very high level and important to Iran and the Iranian culture, and those targets and Iran itself will be hit very fast and very hard. The U.S. wants no more threats. Okay, so be clear here. We have targeted 52 Iranian sites, and they will be hit very hard. So here is a question, multiple questions, being doggedly asked of Kellyanne Conway by a woman named Siobhan Kennedy. Now, you know these are going to be dogged questions. Or I should say, she's from the BBC, Channel 4. You know this is a member of the foreign press because they're willing to burn their access to the White House by asking a relevant question and being dogged about it. As opposed to, like, either one that's going to get me on the anchor desk or one that will get me further access so I can do my book later and make some cash.
Kellyanne, how do you square the fact, though, that the President and Secretary of State do seem to be saying two different things around
They're
the
not.
Cultural? They do seem to be. The President seems to say we are targeting cultural sites, which would be illegal.
He didn't say he's targeting cultural sites.
Did he not say that?
He said that he was openly asking the question, why in the world they're allowed to maim people, put off roadside bombs, kill our people, torture our people.
I thought you said he was targeting 52 sites, some of which were cultural sites within Iran, which would be
he
illegal.
He said that they identified 52 sites.
But so they, can you
Are
say,
you speaking about hypotheticals or I got to deal in reality today.
Well, I'm asking you, is he speaking about hypotheticals, or is he actually targeting those sites?
You're engaging in hypotheticals?
No, she's asking about something the President of the United States said on the record.
Is he speaking about hypotheticals, or are you actually targeting sites which would be illegal, which is exactly
he's identified
what
sites.
Secretary of State Pompeo has said?
Well, he's identified, I mean, everybody can identify cultural sites, but when you say we've targeted them, that means that you've targeted them. Like, I don't even know what, I don't even know what the, in other words.
He's targeted them for identification.
The only other, there is no other word that more explains the idea of targeting than the word target. Like, to make a target. And, you know, remember, Donald Trump has already used Twitter, particularly in the past couple of days. It's like sort of the official way that he's going to notify Congress under the War Powers Act. So I think we can take these fairly seriously. Now, he could be lying, but if he's lying, they should say that. The Pentagon, meanwhile, felt obligated to announce that it we will not be targeting Iranian cultural sites. But this is, it's all mission accomplished for them. And really, I think the big test will be, at least in the context of domestic politics, how it impacts the impeachment hearings we will see over the past in the next couple of days. There's all sorts of weird dynamics with that. And we'll talk more about that later. But I'll say it quickly with this. Mitch McConnell seems to have been able to discipline his caucus, or I should say at the very least, the idea that there's a March deadline for primaries against people like Susan Collins et al. And that has yet to pass. And that has disciplined the caucus in terms of calling for witnesses. The danger that Mitch McConnell has is that Nancy Pelosi will not feel pressure or will get pressure to withhold articles of impeachment as more stuff comes out. I saw a tweet from Lev Parnas's lawyer the other day, yesterday, tweeting out to Kevin McCarthy, time for witnesses, Kevin. And there's a picture of Lev with his arm around Kevin McCarthy. Now, this is after, like, I have no idea what's going on. I have no idea what's going on, but it's nuts. It's really nuts. We're living in a very, very effed up time, folks.
That's Adam Curtis, man.
Yep.
Hypernormalization.
Hey, folks, this program today is sponsored by Grove.co, the Grove Collaborative. Healthy, plant-based, non-toxic cleaning products. They work, folks. And the good ones are actually far more enjoyable to use. In fact, in my neighborhood, like here and in my home, they are exclusively the ones I use now. Partially because I have kids, partially because I'm a little sensitive.
A little bit. Oh, no.
So, but where do you start? Who do you trust? That's where Glove Collaborative comes in. Glove Collaborative is the online marketplace that delivers all natural home, beauty, and personal care products directly to you. You don't have to go out and figure out which is the best brands or what is good. That's what the Glove Collaborative is all about. It takes the guesswork out of going green because every Grove.co, it's Grove.co product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, the planet. For me, those seventh generation, no smell, no dye, no scent hand soaps are key. We got about like a half dozen of those sitting under the sink now, one on top of the sink there, one on top of the bathroom. And The other thing that got that the Grove Collaborative got me into was they have, and I probably should have looked up the name of it, but it's a Grove, I think, branded product where it's a concentrate. And I got a glass bottle. I got a glass spray bottle that has actually like a silicone rubber around it. And I fill up my own cleaning fluid. So I don't have all the crappy bottles. I'm not doing all, you know, it's not a huge deal, but it's less garbage I'm putting out there. But the stuff is safe. I've got it in the bottle. And it does have a smell, but it's not one that bothers me. And it's incredibly effective. Can't beat that 7 generation, though. That's, for me, that's the big one. But now you can join over 500,000 families who trust Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. Plus, shipping is fast and free on your first order. For a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/majority, listen carefully, it's .co/majority, you will get free 5-piece cleaning set from Mrs. Myers and Grove. That's a $30 value. Go to grove.co/majority to get this exclusive cleaning offer. grove.co/majority. Check it out. All right, quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to the editor of Current Affairs, Nathan J. Robinson, on his argument as to why you should be a socialist. Inside a bar, I was sleeping town. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome back to the program the editor of Current Affairs, a periodical you should all be subscribing to, and the author of Why You Should Be a Socialist, Nathan J. Robinson. Welcome to the program, Nathan.
Oh, it's so nice to be back with you, Sam.
So, all right, Nathan, I enjoyed this. I think that this is, you know, just broadly speaking, you know, we get calls from people who are like, what book should we read if I want to become, you know, a socialist or a democratic socialist or a social democrat or something to that effect. And I feel like this is a great sort of gateway book for people. And not only do I think that, I don't think it's just why you should be a socialist, but it's sort of like how, a practical guide, half of it is. But let's just start with this. And I know you don't get too caught up on what a socialist is. But with that said, just give us a vague notion, if you will, or at least a decent one, and contrast and compare for me social democrat versus democratic socialist.
Sure. Yeah. Well, just the thing you said, I mean, I get those all the time, people saying, what should I read? How do I find out, you know, what these things are? And this is sort of my come join the left book. So even if we don't get, you know, bogged down in the terminological disputes for people, you know, broad left. And this is also sort of this is what the left is. This is what we believe. This is what we're fighting for thing. Immediately people get to, okay, well, all right. So what is, very precisely, what is socialism? And of course, it's frustrating. That's a difficult question because socialists have spent the entire history of the socialist movement arguing over what socialism is, with some socialists pointing at each other and saying, you're a social democrat, you're not a real socialist. I start with socialists sort of start with Eugene Debs, and they start with a few kind of principles. The thing that he said about, while there's a lower class, I am in it. While there's a soul in prison, I am not free. So there's this very strong animating ethic of solidarity. This you know, workers of the world unite. This looking at the kind of the proletarian class of the world, really disliking the existence of a class hierarchy, the existence of a small number of people who own stuff and a much larger number of people who sort of do the labor and don't reap so many of the rewards. The term social democracy is a little frustrating because a lot of socialists have called themselves social democrats. The German Social Democratic Party It was a socialist party. Currently, the Prime Minister of Finland is both a member of the Social Democratic Party, which is a member of the Socialist International. So these distinctions aren't always clear. And I think, like, Bernie Sanders, for example, is both a social democrat and a democratic socialist. But the way that I would define, like, if you're a socialist, the core if you're a socialist, is socialists are kind of utopians. They're kind of real radicals who look, you know, many years into the future and who sort of dream of, like, what would happen if we fulfilled all of our core principles, if we had a world in which people were treated fairly and had what they needed. And, you know, and so that's kind of where we start, is with this very, very radical vision for a different world. And I think it's true that if you find people who just call themselves social democrats, they don't quite have that same anime sense of, like, we have a very powerful vision of, well, you know, socialists are always saying a better world is possible.
Right.
And they do. They think about, like, what would it mean if you didn't have a division between the owners and the workers? What would it mean if you had a world without borders? What would it mean if you had a world without war? And that's kind of what you'll find in a lot of socialists that characterizes the tendency.
You know, with the specifics out of the way, and it's, you know, it's funny because I sometimes take phone calls from libertarians, and the first thing that happens is it takes like about 15, 20 minutes before, you know, after they're done slagging every other libertarian who's ever called this program or been interviewed on this program or every other libertarian I've talked to and told me why their libertarianism is not libertarianism. And then they have a very specific libertarianism that they espouse. Yeah. That involves like three or four different adjectives. And so I appreciate the idea that socialism can be sort of a broad term, or at least you perceive it that way. And I think that's one of the things I liked about your book, is that it's sort of got a wide mouth funnel on some level, and trying to bring a lot of people in. Yeah. Let's talk about this notion, though, of utopianism. And because that is one of the things that I think, as I have talked to people over the years, is that and partly because I'm not quite a boomer, but I know that it makes people feel comfortable to think that I am. But I think there is a sort of like, I have been trained to have a lack of imagination. And one of the things that you really promote is to have more of one in terms of like what we would want.
Right. Yeah, I think it's so important, actually. I mean, the word utopianism is considered, you know, dismissed as just idle dreaming. But I think a lot of social progress comes because there are some people who are able to imagine things being very, very different, right? Imagining the end of slavery requires seeing far beyond what's in front of your eyes and really envisioning what a different way of arranging human social relations would be like. And I mean, some people have pointed out that, like, if you existed in a world before the public library, the public library would sound as crazy as some of the schemes that socialists are putting forward today, right? You know, we just want a place where you get free books, you don't have to pay, they just hand them to you, you get to take, right? I mean, you know, free college sounds pretty similar today, and people are saying, well, how on earth would you pay for that, right? How,
right.
Could it give free access to all books to everyone, right? But the socialists are the ones who have said, well, let's think about, what do we really want out of life? What would a good world look like? The globe is kind of, you know, in the form that we've been given, is kind of a Garden of Eden. It is a place with, as George Orwell said, enough provision. It's a raft sailing through space with provisions enough for everyone. So what would our ideal world look like? And that causes socialists to say, well, you know, war shouldn't be taken for granted. It should be considered a problem that we have to eliminate. Borders, militarized borders, are kind of the same way. And can we imagine a world without these things? And that's why you see in every generation, the people who are labeled the socialists are the ones dragging things in the right direction historically, right? So it's Bernie Sanders and AOC who are the only ones pushing an adequate climate plan, or the only ones saying, let's rethink the whole healthcare system from the bottom up. And I think that's always really helpful. The socialists were once the only ones saying, let's have an 8-hour day and a 40-hour week and a weekend. And then those things became normal because people were able to dream of things that other people said were impossible.
And what do you say? And one of the things that I do like about, and I have to say, I also enjoyed, I read one of your reviews, the one where you gave yourself five different reviews from five different perspectives. But one of the things I do like about the book, too, is that you sort of build in some of the critiques that you would get. Yeah. And so let's talk about you sort of break down what conservatism is, what liberalism is. You say that conservatism is cruel, that liberalism is oblivious. Walk us through that, and then let's talk about the conservative critique and the liberal critique, for that matter, of of this utopianism.
So, I mean, conservatism, I mean, I describe it as cruelty because I think even though every conservative is always saying, no, it's just we're just realistic, right? We just understand human nature. But in every generation, you find the conservatives being the ones who rationalize and explain away and justify whatever today looks to us to be cruel and appalling. And so I go through some conservative writings, and you find, you know, real justifications for, like, why people deserve their suffering or why it's okay not to care. And, you know, there's this famous book, The Rhetoric of Reaction, that talks about conservative rhetoric, which is all about, like, how every scheme for social improvement is going to fail. And they say that about anything, no matter what. So part of making progress is rejecting that kind of categorical belief that all attempts at social progress are destined to fail. And, I mean, I'm a pragmatist. I mean, and saying pragmatically, okay, well, that's not true. We don't want to adopt the conservative position here. You know, we do want to make social progress carefully, but we have to still believe in it. Now, liberalism, this is, liberalism is a term that has applied to everyone from, you know, Friedrich von Hayek, the classical liberals, to, you know, Barack Obama, to Elizabeth Warren, to, like, you know, so what does it really mean? Well, I try and do is distinguish where the people who call themselves socialists differ from people who call themselves liberals. Now, they often share a lot of overlap. There's more overlap between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren than there is between Bernie Sanders and Barack Obama or Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar, right? But, you know, what is the dividing line that says that Elizabeth Warren isn't a socialist and Bernie Sanders is? And one of the dividing lines is a real antagonism to, as I said, class divides and hierarchy, right? So socialists have always been the ones that look inside the workplace and say, like, we need democratically controlled workplaces. We need to eliminate the distinction between owners and workers, landlords and tenants, right? So, like, a liberal is the one who wants regulation, who says that there should be, you know, rent regulation. We should, you know, make sure that landlords treat their tenants well. The socialist is the one that says the idea that some people own the houses and the other people have to pay them rent, that whole distinction needs to eventually be broken down. Socialists have always also been, like, because they have this Workers of the World Unite perspective, they have been way more consistently anti-war than people who describe themselves as liberal. And you really see that. I mean, you were just talking about Iran. You really see that in the presidential candidate responses to the attack on Soleimani, which is like, you know, Bernie Sanders is very much more consistently anti-war and anti-American imperialism than any of the other candidates.
I mean, you know, one of the things, I mean, just to circle back around to the conservatism and the human nature argument, which I find fascinating, is that there's a claim that we're just talking about human nature, but it really isn't just that. It is a moral judgment upon human nature. Because if you just took human nature as it was, you'd accept that there are some people who are not going to be as materially productive as others, right? Like, that's just human nature. And you would accept that and simply say, still, they deserve a certain, basic level of human dignity that we all do, or that we should all share one that is at least within certain bounds of being, you know, recognizable to each other. But the conservative mentality is, it seems to me, to exploit human nature and to perceive it as problematic in some way.
There's a kind of implicit social Darwinism that says that, like, people deserve what they get in the big sort of brutal competitive struggle. Milton Friedman said, you know, our philosophy is not from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. It's from each according to, like, what they are capable of producing in the market to what they're capable of producing in the market. But that what that means is that people who are like children who are disabled, who are old, who are caregivers, they don't get any rewards, right? And we see that in the market. Those are the people who end up poor. So, like, there is this, and the people who end up with the most end up being the people who are most willing to prey on and exploit other people. They're not actually the innovators, right? If you look at the billionaires, they're generally not inventors. They're not people who invent products for the most part. They are people who are capable of, as Peter Thiel says, cornering a market, getting between people. Peter Thiel invented PayPal, right, which is just a middleman that siphons off some money. So they're those sorts of people. There's a real idea that not only are we motivated by self-interest, which is not true. Anyone who, like, knows people knows that that's just not really true. We're a cooperative species for the most part, except the libertarian. But that self-interest is legitimate. Like, it is legitimate to solely pursue your own ends. There is a stamp of approval on this human nature, this brutal human nature. And that stamp of approval allows us to justify, you know, anything you do that makes money is good. There's no distinction between price and value, right? Anything, the amount someone pays for something, that's what it's worth. The amount that you're paid, that's what you're worth. If a CEO is paid, 300 times more than their employees, it's not because they have just been able to exploit the nature of power relations in society. It's because they are 300 times more important and better. And so there's this sense that, like, power and strength kind of are virtue. And that's obviously very frightening.
Right. Well, I'm asking that because I want to sort of, like, with that frame, right, with the social Darwinism frame and that sort of the value and price frame, right? Because, like, one could argue that the reason why CEOs are getting 300 times, X or whatever the number is, right? The reason why the $10 million is because there is a virus in the market. There's a flaw in the market. There's a certain asymmetry, and that it really, the number shouldn't be 300 times X. It should really be, 100 times X, or something to that effect. Where on that spectrum, when you describe liberalism, what is it there? Because where I'm ultimately going to this is, like, is there a precondition that you have to have in terms of a way that you view the world to be a socialist, to have a socialistic perspective on things? But talk about that liberalism first.
Yeah. So I would say that if the difference between the rhetoric that you hear coming out of socialists and coming out of people who would be categorized as liberals on this particular issue would be, liberals would probably point out that, this compensation seems unfairly high. We probably want to curb, but there would be a very strong appeal to companies to regulate themselves. This is why you see, like, this business roundtable thing, which is, like, calling on corporations to be their best selves.
Right. This is the corporate roundtable. Like, 50 CEOs got together and said, "We can do better, guys." And I do mean guys.
Yes. Yeah. We're good. We're the good corporations. We're going to live up to our values. We don't fully accept that the only thing a corporation is supposed to do is maximize shareholder value. There are stakeholders and whatever. The socialists are very critical of things like this because socialists, basically, as I say, want to dismantle, like, the class division. So, like, even if a CEO is, like, a somewhat better person and gets a little bit less money, they're still within the workplace a dictator, right? I mean, it's still an undemocratic workplace.
Elizabeth Anderson has this great book, Private Government, about how corporations, if we conceive of them as private governments, which we probably ought to because people spend so much of their time being ruled by the rules of their workplace, the structure of a corporation is the structure of a dictatorship. You don't get to vote for your boss. There's no democracy there. If you don't like them, tough. You know, your option is to leave, just as in like a country, your option is to like either migrate or stick around and put up with it. And so that's kind of the difference between the way that a socialist looks at these things and a way that a liberal looks at it, is socialists talk a ton about power and who has it, and have you really changed who has power? And just because you've got the benevolent dictator, have you really solved the ultimate underlying problem? And the other thing that socialists say is that there's kind of a naivete to believing that you can solve things while keeping power relations pretty intact, right? So if you have better CEOs, they might try and incorporate stakeholder interests or what have you. But ultimately, if a corporation is structured to where it's supposed to maximize shareholder value, there's going to be a shareholder revolt if you go too far, right?
Right.
The CEO of ExxonMobil, right? Their job. Like if they can't come out and say like I think that what our company should be dismantled, right? It's impossible. There are incentives. The reason that like the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel industry lied so much and manipulated the public was that they kind of had to. That was the nature of the institution. If you wanted to remain profitable, you had to find every possible way to keep the public from revolting against what you do.
I think that's well put. I mean, it's nice that these 50 CEOs get together and decide that, you know, they're going to really make a strong effort to do better. But why do they get to choose? Like, why do they get to set the parameters? It's really just sort of asking, like, why is it like this when it doesn't really have to be? I mean, corporations do not exist in nature. They are a social construct. They are not even a social construct. They're a governmental construct.
They're made by the state. State gives them limited liability and then enforces that.
If a conservative is one who, in many respects, applauds this sort of this power structure, because what it does is in some ways, it's not that far from the monarchy, right? It's like it's blessed. If it exists, it exists because God wanted it that way. We may have substituted the word market for God, but the market is moral. God is moral. If you're poor, you're immoral. If you lost the raffle, it's because God didn't want you to have the winning ticket, that type of thing. And liberals say, like, well, we think our God should be a little bit more merciful. And so we're okay with the structure, but we want to take the rough edges off. Or we want to take a lot of the edges off, but the structure will remain. If socialists, broadly speaking, want to change that power structure, does there need to be a precondition? Like, I mean, is this just simply something that you are born with, or is this something that you, I mean, honestly, like, you know, is it, is this just something that you adopt intellectually?
I don't, that's hard to answer, right? Because that requires a bit of psychoanalysis. I don't know why. I mean, I do know, I talk about how, like, all the people I know who have been socialists have been people who really have this kind of deep disgust with so many systemic features of the world around them they see, right? And if, another example, I think of the liberalism-socialism divide, was I was thinking, like, if you lived under feudalism, liberalism would be like minimum wages and maximum hours for peasants. And socialism would be like the entire idea of feudalism, of having power concentrated in the lords.
is just wrong and despicable. And so I do think, like, I talk about how, like, socialists are kind of unreasonable people, right? I mean, Bernie Sanders, right? I used to not think he deserved the label socialist. I really come around to it because, I, as you read the history of socialism, you see that a lot of the socialists, like people like Eugene Debs, are the people like Bernie Sanders who are standing there alone on the floor of the House going, like, I will not tolerate another war. They are people who have just like this uncontrollable discontent. And this real feeling that something around them is very troublingly wrong, because they have that utopian vision, because they look at the world and they see the difference between what is and what could be. And that's why so many of us are so unpersuaded when people like Steven Pinker or Nicholas Kristof go like, but things are getting better on this chart. And you go, well, things are getting slightly better on the chart, but actually the real measure is the gap between what is possible and what we have managed to do. And that gap might actually be growing all the time, because like the more, as you increase production, as it's easier and easier to provide for everyone, it becomes more and more morally grotesque if you haven't.
I mean, that is, I think that is the nub, right? It's not where you are in a vacuum. It is where you are relative to where you could be, based upon the potential or resources that, and that you could describe you as an individual, it could describe you as a society or a planet for that matter. I think that's a great point. So one of the things also I like about what you've written is that you build in some of these critiques. What about, I mean, why would we want to be like Venezuela, we have a former speaker of the House is trying to climb fences and getting kicked out of parliament. Why would anyone want that? And or address the critique that we wouldn't want the social safety net to become a hammock?
Yeah, okay. Well, the Venezuela thing, I mean, the challenge that I pose is like, okay, if socialism is a kind of, if economic socialism, right, which is distinguished from that kind of moral socialist instinct, is like, worker ownership. Like, was it worker ownership that was the problem in Venezuela? And the answer is no, it was authoritarianism. The problem was authoritarianism. And so authoritarian socialism is just as much of a problem as right-wing authoritarian fascism. Authoritarianism really does destroy a country. And so that should be something that we all oppose, right? Which is why I identify with what is called the libertarian socialist tradition. And those people have always been the ones who, every time someone in the name of socialism, in the name of empowering workers, ended up crushing the workers, as Bakunin said, beating people with a stick, but calling it the people's stick. We have said, no, the problem is that the state is beating people with a stick. So, and I mean, I also think that we, you know, it's very cherry picked, right? Because everyone was looking at Venezuela while no one was looking at poverty reduction in Bolivia. Nobody looks at you know, the activities of socialists in the United States, right? Like Bernie Sanders was an incredibly effective mayor of Burlington. He's widely praised. He started a community land trust in the name of socialism. And is that, was he an authoritarian? Did he act like Lenin? No, he didn't. You know, socialists ran the city of Milwaukee for many years. They ran it really well. So, you know, you can't cherry pick. You have to look at the entire history of socialism and say, okay, there is a version of socialism that actually seems to do a lot of good. There is a version of something that is kind of a perversion of the ideals of socialism, and we need to reject that categorically. The social safety net becoming a hammock, you know, it's kind of funny because nobody asks this about capital income. Right. Nobody asks whether, like, the rich getting richer off passive income from capital makes them lazy. Right. Which is so much more income. I mean, I really feel like, first, I'm not anti-hammock. Hammocks for all. It seems very, I mean, actually, though, I mean, the real serious answer is, if you change the nature of work so that work is really enjoyable, so that workplaces don't feel like dictatorships that you have to drag yourself to, if you really, I mean, there's nothing inherently miserable about doing tasks, about being productive. It doesn't have to be that way. If you structure something, I mean, I'm a workaholic now. I come to work all the time because I have a job where
you know, we are a democratic workplace. We have a very good culture here at Current Affairs. And everyone, you know, likes to work because we've, you know, we kind of fix it. Because if you don't have a tyranny, if you're not working for the benefit of someone else, some tiny class of owners, but you're getting the rewards of what you do, then there is an incentive to work. And then it doesn't matter that you've got a safety net because you've also at the same time eliminated the thing that is the disincentive to work, which is that actually having a job turns out to really, really suck when it's such a dehumanizing and alienating experience.
Let me just get back to the sort of the Venezuela question. Is there a danger though? Okay, of socialism, what you call libertarian socialism, or democratic socialism, let's say, right? Sliding into an authoritarianism. Yeah. Like, is there is the ballast that that keeps it from drifting into that type of, of scenario?
I think it should be the big lesson of the 20th century, right? Not that socialism is bad, but that, like, you need to build into your politics a way of avoiding the slide into authoritarianism and, you know, avoiding rationalizations for crushing dissidents. The thing is that actually the socialists in the United States have a fantastic record on civil liberties. They've always been the ones that have pointed out when the government is unfairly targeting dissidents. Now, the question is, would we do the same thing if we obtained power? And the answer is you have to really make sure that your philosophy is very pro-liberty, is very pro-speech, is very pro-open debate and discussion, and is very anti-state violence. I mean, the thing is, like, socialists in the United States are mostly prison abolitionists. They're mostly anti-death penalty. They are mostly in favor of massively scaling back the militarization of the police. Well, if you value civil liberties and your worry is creeping authoritarianism, it seems to me like that's the team you should be on, is the team that is trying to release as many people from prison as possible.
Right. And I guess we have, you know, theoretically at least, or I should say, nominally, some example of the potential dangers of authoritarianism in a country that is not socialist like this one. right. I mean, that's
funny because, like, we have the Gulag Archipelago. We've got millions of people. Like, we're the freest country in the world, and we've got so many people in prison, and yet people say, well, what about the possibility that you become a police state? My God, heaven forbid.
Right. Let's move on to here's one more question I have on the book, and then I want to just talk a little bit about the election, because I know you've just written a piece about why Biden is no good in the general, and I want to ask you about Warren and Bernie in that respect. But why do you think this is happening now? Like, why do you think the Jacobin is, you know, and I'm looking at a polling that shows, I don't know, 11% of Democrats, I think, identify as socialists, which I imagine is up. But certainly we know that a higher percentage of Democrats are okay with socialists. And broadly speaking, what do you think has changed? I mean, is it generational? Is it simply a function of the context of the times? Or is it both? What is it?
Well, partly it's generational. I mean, I talk about in the book, you know, my experience growing up during the financial crisis and during the Iraq War, and watching people who were quote unquote liberals and progressive Democrats supporting that war, and also, like, the Obama presidency radicalized the young people who sort of believed in it, and then they saw his foreign policy, and then they saw his, like, education reform quote policy, and they, you know, and they're having his healthcare, you know, his compromises on healthcare, and then they realized, okay, well, clearly, if this is what being a progressive Democrat is, I'm to the left of this. And then someone who called himself a socialist came along and said, well, I actually have, you know, much bolder plans.
And they said, oh, okay, well, then that's if that's what socialism is, that's what I identify as. So I think Bernie Sanders made a huge difference to this because you saw the discontent in Occupy in 2011. You really saw, like, that was a lot of frustrated young people gathering and sort of, you know, talking about debt and talking about precarity and the nature of work. But it didn't sort of identify as a socialist movement. And then it wasn't until Sanders' run that you really saw, like, a lot of people coming together under the socialist label and the DSA's membership taking off. And I think it was because people began to see, like, socialism as a coherent vision for what an alternative would be. And, yeah, it is mostly young people because young people are the most frustrated. But so that's how I would describe it. I'd say Bernie Sanders has a lot to do with it. And also, like, the nature of growing up in this economy with America's, you know, disastrous militaristic foreign policy hanging over us all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's been fascinating just from my perspective because the word socialism, I mean, the people identifying in American politics as socialists. I mean, and I say this as someone who interviewed Bernie on my radio show in 2004. And, when we talked about him being, political independent, I think, but a socialist. And I mean, so he was out there. I think he was as surprised as anybody at how well he did in 2016, frankly. I think maybe even too late to realizing in the context of that race, yes, how well he was doing.
Absolutely.
And then suddenly it just caught on like wildfire. It's almost as if there was a tremendous amount of tinder on the ground and he was, he just came up and lit the match again, and this time the context was right.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, I mean, you kind of see a kind of an unfortunate parallel in Britain where, like, Jeremy Corbyn spent, like, 30 years as a backbencher that was suddenly elevated to the leadership, not because he was considered really the best leader, but because there was this tinder, and it was like this, movement of young radical lefties. And I mean, it turned out like he really struggled to actually then deliver the kind of leadership that mandate requires you to deliver. I think Bernie's actually a much better politician, but it was the same kind of situation where like the undercurrents of the desire for an alternative was just waiting for someone, anyone to come along and say like, I have it, join me.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think, in this instance, I mean, I think if there was another version of Bernie, they would be more popular than Bernie at this point. I mean, if there wasn't this sort of large gap between, people in their 30s and Bernie in terms of like subscribing to these politics, I think that, that person if Barack Obama,
if he was 20 years younger, 30 years younger,
right, he would be defeating him, as it were, or she more than likely would be defeating him in that instance. Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating in that respect. All right. Well, I was going to ask you for the case as to why Bernie Sanders is more electable than Joe Biden, but apparently Matt Iglesias beat you to that today.
He made it for me.
But let's talk about Biden because I think Biden's and Bernie seems to be honing in on this right now too. Like this has been the unspoken belief, I think, frankly, of a huge swath of the Democratic Party. I would include large segments of the establishment that Joe Biden is just ill suited to win. And the perception by a significant number of rank and file Democrats, and I would say probably the highest propensity voting Democrats, that Joe Biden can win. And that's just speculation on my part, is wrong. Walk us through that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's understandable why so many prospective Biden voters default to the assumption that he's a pragmatic candidate, right? I mean, he was the vice president, so he ran and won, you know, admittedly with Barack Obama in two national elections, and, you know, he's been in Washington forever. He's got, you know, what they consider folksy appeal to win the Midwest and the Rust Belt or whatever. I think it's, as you say, wrong, because if you actually look at Biden's performance in this campaign, it's not just, you know, many of us on the left are like, but he's rambling and incoherent. Well, you know, that's partially true. But it's also that he has nobody's really enthusiastic for Biden. And I think that really hurt Hillary Clinton in 2016. And Biden has it worse. There were people who were enthusiastic for Hillary, but I don't know that anyone's going around knocking doors in the middle of winter, like dedicating themselves to Joe Biden. You know, that's kind of a joke, right? He has not really much of an operation. His fundraising has been really bad, while Donald Trump has a giant war chest building up. He doesn't really have a message beyond, like, Trump is a liar. You know, that's no malarkey. So he's got no movement, no message, no organization. No enthusiasm. That's bad, right? And he also has a bunch of really vulnerable spots, just like Hillary Clinton did. I mean, Donald Trump's an anti-establishment candidate, and Biden is like the definite. He's been in Washington since he was 30. He's involved in this, like, I mean, this Ukraine thing, which, like, they say he didn't do anything wrong, but it's like a mess. It looks bad. It's something you have to explain. It's easy to run against and say, like, Joe Biden's a representative of the corrupt establishment. Joe Biden voted for all the shit, he runs against, like, the Iraq war. I mean, the Iraq war is the big thing that, you know, Biden now has to pretend. He has to pretend. He has to lie and say that he opposed it, right? Because he knows that this is such a weak spot. So he just goes around saying that he opposed the Iraq war from the start. And that's a massive vulnerability if the Republicans will just call you out on a massive lie that you're telling all the time, even as your whole campaign is why the other guy is a liar and I'm no malarkey, a return right. to honesty, dignity, and respectability.
That, to me, that dynamic right there is the biggest problem. It is the way in which he is most like that the matchup between Clinton and Trump is most like the matchup between Biden and Trump, because Biden is running on character. And that means that you are playing in an arena, regardless of whether he could have the greatest character or not. It doesn't matter. He's playing in an arena that is the only arena that Donald Trump knows how to play in, which is, I am going to throw mud at your character. You're going to throw mud at my character. And then Donald Trump wins because he has sort of like an adamant psychotic following who also know that he's going to deliver what is important to them materially, which is essentially a Supreme Court and lower taxes. Those are the two things that they really, you fulfill the entire Republican wish list there. You'll have special interests who want, like, hey, can you get rid of, like, can I dump more toxins in the river? Sure, we can handle that. But that's not a campaign pledge. But the bottom line is, that is how you depress votes. You go after when you're in the arena of character. I think that's what makes Sanders so strong as a candidate against Trump is that Bernie Sanders is not running on his character. People can project stuff onto his character, but Bernie Sanders is never going up there saying, like, you know, I'm going to restore dignity to the White House. He may have said it, but I don't think people associate it with him. He is going up there and saying, like, I'm going to do certain policies. And Donald Trump is going to say, you're a socialist. But the problem is that Trump does not have a next sentence to that.
Yes,
he
I know.
He can't even explain what that means. He can't say, like, you don't want to cut Medicare. He can't say anything after that.
I'm telling you, I've dreamed of a Bernie Sanders debate against Donald Trump, right? Because, like, Bernie Sanders goes, we're going to deliver for you. Here's what we're going to deliver. You're never going to have to worry about whether you can afford your health insurance anymore. You're never going to have to worry about whether your kids can afford college. right? And what is what alternative does Donald Trump have beyond the word socialism? He has nothing. And Bernie Sanders is going to run against the ideal character for him, which is a cartoon of an out of touch billionaire who doesn't care about anyone else. It's perfect. And so he's the ideal anti-Trump candidate, not anti any Republican, but Trump specifically.
I agree. I mean, I felt this in 2016.
He was like worried about like his family coming over, and he's worried about like his paycheck with Uber. And I was like, Bernie Sanders has a message for that guy, which is we're going to fix immigration, we're going to fix your wages. Biden has nothing. Biden has nothing to say to that guy.
The irony is that I think that while Hillary Clinton could have beaten anyone else in the Republican field, I also feel that it's quite possible that anyone else in the Republican field could have beaten Bernie. But I just think that in terms of, and I'm talking 2016, but I'm talking in terms of matching up against Donald Trump, Bernie is the only candidate who clearly, and I think, and I want to ask you a little bit about Warren before you go, because I think Warren, I think frankly there's been a misstep in her campaign. And I think that they didn't understand, sort of what lane she was running in. And they tried to sort of become the compromise candidate, and you don't become a compromise. You are chosen as a compromise. On some level, but Bernie is it's like two basketball teams, one that is playing a running game, the other is playing a post up game. It's like you don't play their game, and Sanders couldn't play their game if he wanted to, and Trump has no ability to play any other game. Warren could have been that candidate, but give me a sense of Warren's candidacy.
Yeah, I mean, but it's frustrating because with Warren, like a lot, the one thing that you really need if you're going to run against Donald Trump is you really need a powerful sense that you are authentic, that you're not a calculating Washington politician, right? And Warren has done things that give a sense of inauthenticity, that give a sense that like she's trying to figure out what her beliefs should be for the purposes of the campaign. Like, should I run? Should I say the word single payer? Is that good? Is that not good? Maybe I should just say Medicare for all and then kind of not say that it's going to be something that takes away private health insurance. And that really hurts her because then people are like, oh, well, I don't trust you, right? And, I think it does hurt Warren that she has a long history of, like, changing her politics. Right. I mean, yeah, she spent 40 years as a Republican or whatever. She was a Republican until the 40s. People can change. It helps Bernie, though, that he has been doing this since he was 18, getting dragged away from the civil rights protests. Right. With Warren, like, yeah, she changed and evolved, but also like she's gotten much more radical for the purposes of this campaign, where she started talking way more like Bernie Sanders on a bunch of things. On foreign policy, she's very evasive. She has, I actually think the Native American thing is horrible for her because if authenticity is the issue, it's an issue where, like, she might have spent decades, like, kind of pretending to be a Native American without not being one. Like, it's going to really hurt her that, like, she doesn't have this powerful sense of who she really, really is that Bernie Sanders is able to convey to people. And you can see in the way that they talk to voters who disagree with them. But I mean, Bernie's so good at like flipping Trump voters in like 3 minutes by getting them to trust him, by explaining like his core convictions, and they turn around and they come on board. And I just like, I don't think Warren has this kind of organizer's mentality. I don't think she has the long track record of fighting that she's going to be able to point to. And I think she's just like weak on a bunch of issues and waffling and vacillating in a way that is going to allow Trump to exploit it and is not going to play well with voters.
Let me dissent a little bit from your view to a certain extent. I think that I disagree that she's inauthentic, and I think her policies have been pretty remarkably consistent and And she has been a fighter for a lot of these same values. I don't think she has the same take necessarily on power that Bernie would, because but in the end, I'm not sure that from a practical implication at this day and age and this era would necessarily make a difference. I think the problem has been really just sheer political. Now, I think like Bernie has an advantage because he can afford to not have political savvy, because that's just not the kind of politician he has been his entire career. Like, he hasn't had to be a politician because he hasn't been in a position where he is, you know, sort of like he just has one position and has been on that for a long time. And by political, I mean, she, I think, made a political miscalculation in responding to the question, how are you going to pay for your Medicare for all? I think she made a political miscalculation in trying to present a plan as to how you're going to roll it out. Bernie has not provided the level of detail in paying for it as Warren has. And his rollout plan, not, you know, the only thing that she, I think, made a mistake about was to say it was going to be in two tranches. She didn't need to do that. It was, there was, I think there is a lack of confidence. Like there too many times we look at politics and say, what lane are you going to be in? And we define that ideologically, as opposed to what lane are you going to be in like strong and wrong, or detail, you know, detail bogged down and precise. Or there are other lanes that I think voters see. And I think that when she felt like she had to respond to, I don't think that her belief that she was, you know, had a Native American ancestry was nearly as egregious as the idea that she needed to respond to Donald Trump about it. F you, Donald Trump.
Well, yeah,
my mom told me that we were, you know, you, whatever. Everybody understands in this country some idea of like, you know, I thought we came from Hungary. It turns out I came from Poland. They sell all the 23andMe's based upon that, right? Like, everybody understands that concept. Yeah. Why feel like you have to address him to explain it? Why feel like you have to address anybody? Stick to your beliefs, stay with it. And I think it has become, at least in my mind, a concern about her her political apparatus, which is developed by, you know, her advisors are picked by her. And at the end of the day, like it shows a vulnerability that I would be concerned about in a general election.
She definitely responds too much to Trump. I mean, you know, she rolled out her campaign with DNA test video.
Exactly.
And I don't even know if the DNA test was supposed to be like, I am actually a Native American, right? Because the whole point of presenting a DNA test is to say that you're right, like, or she's not, like, she's backing off. Like,
well, she clearly believed that she was. And so the idea being that, like, exactly, like, why are you responding to Donald Trump? The only way you're going to beat Donald Trump is by showing the American public that this guy's a joker, and he's a joker by you don't address him. Like, go F yourself. No. I don't need to justify anything to you, Donald Trump. And frankly, we're in an era where we want our politicians to say we don't need. I mean, I think that's why Biden, frankly, to the extent that he has the support he does. Everything I find offensive about Joe Biden, I think, is part of the reason why he's doing as well as he does. Because he goes, you know, bless me, Father, for I have sinned, is his way of saying, go F yourself.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny because I think, you know, many of the left criticisms of Biden aren't really landing, because, like, the fact that he's rambling does mean that he's, like, very much an unscripted politician, right? He's not robotic. You never know what's going to come out of his mouth. That kind of his, like, you know, his confrontations with voters, they might actually help him. He's got like a Trump-like quality to him, which is to like, go F yourself. I don't care what anyone thinks.
But anyways, interesting discussion on that. But the real point is, folks, why you should be a socialist. Nathan J. Robinson, the editor of Current Affairs. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. I think this is a great present to give to your cousin or your niece or nephew or your uncle or your aunt to push them over the edge. And now is the time. Nathan Robinson, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Sam. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Couple of breaking news while we were... prosecutors have recommended Michael Flynn serve up to 6 months in prison. Trump's, this is, you will recall, he was the former national security advisor to Donald Trump, who was in the lead up to, I think, in the, while he was the national security advisor elect, I guess you could say. He was trying to swing a deal where he would kidnap a Turkish dissident cleric and to return him to Turkey, which, you know, he was doing it for cash. And so why wouldn't you with his son? I guess they were going to do some type of Cobra style type of thing. And he cooperated with Mueller investigation and then Dad. He came back and said, like, oh, no, actually, the government tricked me into cooperating. And so prosecutors just said, well, he's being a jerk off. So give him 6 months.
CIA's just like deceiving you, Dad.
It's,
we could have kidnapped that guy, got like $5 million and moved to Tora Bora.
The deep state.
What the hell?
The deep state was out to get him. That same deep state that said Soleimani is going to attack us.
Imminently.
Yeah. He's also one of these, you know, idiots who planted all these seeds about Iran in Trump's head in 2016. If you read about Michael Flynn, Michael Flynn is obsessed with Iran. And might be also the guy, there's an old Mehdi Hassan interview before Trump announced where Flynn is ambiguous on the idea of killing terrorist family members. So
yeah,
he was a really positive influence in Trump world.
Folks, we got to take a quick break and head into the fun half. We're a little bit doing this, went a little long today. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member. By going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you become a member, you make this show possible day in, day out. And as a way of saying thank you, we strip the ads from the first half of the show, and then we give you extra content every single day. So jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And AMQ, the AM Quickie. It's available on the Majority app, and it is also available at amquickie.com, amquickie.com. 5 minutes every morning, headlines so that you know what your day is going to look like. And every day, I have gotten some very good feedback on it, that you know, people who want to maintain some touch with politics but can't handle too much every single day, AM Quickie provides that for you. Today is Tuesday. That means that tonight people are going to be messing up this table. Right? Isn't that right, Michael?
Like no.
Crumbs, crumb-laden foods.
Total fake news. Incredible. It's actually the other way around, which I have to clear off all of your coffee cups and your little various iced coffee situations. Sometimes I've literally come in here and there are two iced coffees in two different places on your desk.
I like to have
both
one
half
here.
Drift,
I can
both.
Do this and I can do like, you know.
And the really
like
disgusting
that.
Thing is the used toothpicks, which I have to work around.
Oh, the toothpicks.
Which is grotesque.
Well, so. I don't know what you shouldn't be. What are you doing here? Over here? This area is
well,
my area.
The toothpick I have to deal with when I host on Thursdays.
Right. So, all right. Yeah. I'll do better on Wednesdays.
Yeah. You got to work on it. So thank you for giving me that opportunity. Tonight on TMBS, we're talking with Drew Mikael, who is a fellow at Queen's University, about how the warmongering against Iran is affecting the social movements that were emerging across the MENA region, and also, you know, the latest in terms of the escalation. Then Matt Chrisman is stopping by. He hasn't been on the show for quite some time. We're going to talk about sewer socialism or the end of the world, Judge Judy getting in on the Mike Bloomberg train, Andrew Yang, not just his answer on healthcare, but really the just sort of total defeat that his politics represents, and a whole bunch more. Really excited about February 7th at the Bell House. This is the time I really want to start encouraging people to get your tickets. Jam-packed show, Alona Minkowski, Ben Burgess, Harvey Kay, Pretty Bad Lefty, Brandon Sutton, and actually Matt Binder. So there's some nostalgia to that show as well. You can grab the tickets. And of course, he hosts Doom, which is great. Grab your tickets. There's a link on the Majority.fm homepage. See you tonight.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have an epic 3-part series recapping the entirety of the decade, starting in 2009, just to be on the safe side, because I know some people aren't too sure where decades end and begin.
Don't appease them, Jamie. Reject those people.
Well, you know, it's also good to get a little bit of a prologue for whatever history that you're talking about. We have the very smart and funny Jake Flores and Simone Norman on as guests. We talk about so many things. The Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, the Fappening, the 2016 election, the rise of the hashtag resistance, and more. And the third part of this is coming out tomorrow as a free episode. So check it out, folks. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Brendan, you are not Matt.
Literary hangover.
Right now, he's reading a poem.
Yeah, he's reading a poem. I was going to say, sell it.
Doing some sort of epic, I guess.
George Orwell.
I'm not sure which.
This is Gilgamesh at 6x speed.
All right, folks. See you in the fun.
I have a plug. My band is playing live on Friday in Bushwick, if you're in New York.
Sweet.
Yeah.
All you Brendan heads.
Oh, I forgot.
At Gold Sounds.
Don't make it weird, though.
I knew there was something that I had to do this for.
You want
to
say the location?
I had to get a babysitter for that.
It's at Gold Sounds in Bushwick, and I was going to pull up the poster, but I forgot to do that. So I'll do that Thursday.
It's awesome.
But yeah, come check it out.
All right, let's see. Brendan, I'm putting that right in right now. All right, we can take a quick break. 646-257-3920. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. Are you nervous?